Hello and welcome to Radio Book Club on Big Cabbage Radio 89.7. I'm Judy Getty and I'll be hosting the show today as we discuss Mary McGrory, the trailblazing columnist who stood Washington on its head by John Norris. My guests are Terry Snyder and Heather Rez. Welcome.
Well, great to be here. What an honor.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, ladies. So before we get started, I want to remind our listeners that the show is being pre-recorded, so we will not be taking calls. March is National Women's History Month, and I'm always amazed when I discover a woman who made significant contributions to our country that many people have not heard of. And I was appalled that I had never heard of her. And I don't know if you guys had any reflection on that or...
I really didn't. I have to fess up to that, too. But I bet Heather didn't know her.
No. New really? To me as well.
Huh.
And do either of you have a background in journalism that you actually, like, studied? Journalism? Come on, Heather, fess up.
Yes.
A degree, maybe, or
yes, and I ran screaming from the newsroom. Background.
Okay.
So, but when I think of it, I can't just think about Helen Thomas. I mean, to me, that's been the consistent woman that sort of fits that mold. So I was delighted to read.
Isn't it appalling that we have, like, a token woman? Who's the, you know, correspondent, the Washington correspondent? Oh, the Helen Thomas. Yeah, we never.
And she's dead.
Yeah. So was Mary McGrory.
Yeah. So, and there are still definitely some women. I mean, there's more now than there ever was women correspondents, but those pillars
Yes.
hard to come by now.
So what I want to do is I want to talk a little bit about Mary as a person, because I think that in her case, I think when you kind of, you know, do that kind of postmortem, you really start to look at what kind of person this was. And that really tells you then why she wrote the way she did. And why she saw the world the way she did. And then we'll talk about some of her experiences and some of her writing. But we were talking a little bit before we came in here, and there's some faults with the book, naturally. But I think overall, Norris does a pretty good job at least giving me a picture of Mary. And I, like we admitted, we didn't know of her. So I can't say, well, he got it wrong. He might have got it wrong. But so what did you pick up with what just in general, what kind of person she is?
She seemed to be an observer of life and of history, and more so, I think, an observer than, for lack of a better word, a participant. That she chose a career over being a wife, a mother, having a family, and so her immortality comes in a different way. She has to be remembered for her professional contributions, and that's different than choosing a life where your immortality is your family and your children.
Mm-hmm. Especially during that time. To me, it was just a stunning, I mean, during her era of having that and being how she easily stepped in and out of those worlds with grace, it sounds like. And I mean, her political finesse was just amazing, I think. That's what I appreciated about her.
And just to put it into some historical context, she's working at the Star in the late 50s and she's doing book reviews. When she sort of gets noticed for her writing skills and starts to be able to write a column. So really, I think, you know, that is pointed out very clearly in the book that she chose a career over marrying and having a family. That for women, it really was that clear of a choice.
Well, and her beginning to have that opportunity to write for the news section began with that conversation with the boss saying, "Are you ever going to get married?" In the newsroom in a very loud and public way. Was just sort of understood that if you had a home life, you were going to drop out of the professional world and you wouldn't have your long-term career.
Which was pretty par for the course during that time of life. I mean, women made those choices all the time. Even if they went to college and had the ability to go out and make a living, which was still less than what a man could make then and now, they still had to make those choices. They were always the one to stay home and give up those professional careers.
I think that here we are 50 years later, and there's still women who feel that way.
Mm-hmm. I definitely have women I attended university with who've never used their degrees. I mean, they're great moms and contribute in other ways, but it's still sort of one or the other. We ask people to choose, mm-hmm. women to choose.
Right. Women.
So we should also mention she's Irish. But it's kind
Very.
Of yeah. But it's kind of funny. I mean, she has a German mother, but she never wants to acknowledge her German mother or her German heritage. She wants to sort of let everybody believe she's 100% Irish, and this defines, again, who she is and how she sees the world.
I wonder if that was, I kept thinking that, the reason was of her closeness with the Kennedy tribe and as Irish as they are and how seamlessly she sort of fit in. It's almost part of the family in a lot of regards, especially with Jack and kind of the earlier Kennedys. So, and they were very Irish and very proud of their heritage. And I always wondered if that was part of it, that she, you know, why that was important to her.
I think part of it probably was, too, that time in history was just on the heels of World War II, when it might not have been very popular at all to say, hi, I'm a German ancestry. And
good point.
We did all these maybe not so good things. And I mean, you had more to gain by being Irish than by being German at that moment in time.
She was certainly seemed closer to her father. People talked about how she would discuss her relationship with her father, but her mother, she wouldn't speak so much about.
The book doesn't even really explain her mother. It has a sentence or two that says she probably couldn't have gone to Washington and pursued this career if Aunt Kate, or whatever the aunt's name was, hadn't stayed home and taken care of the mother. But it offers no context. Why did the mother need care?
Right.
And
but again, comes back to, you know, she was only free to do it because another woman stepped into a caretaking role that she wasn't going to do. But it was nice that
that came at the very end of the book, though. So it was acknowledged, but it was kind of at the end of the book, as I remember it, that she talked about that.
Right. But it doesn't say, was her mom, did she have MS or did she have dementia, or why did she require care that Mary was doing and had somebody else had to step in?
True.
Well, maybe it was just
phrased like she needed a
maybe
caregiver.
Maybe it was just age, too, because her Aunt Kate was pretty elderly when she passed away.
Mm-hmm.
So, and like you said, they didn't specify it to say whether it was lifelong a care or if it was just care at the end of her final days.
I was thinking more about the Irish thing, too, that, you know, in some ways when to identify as Irish seems really clannish, more so than to identify as German. And so later on, when she hasn't brought up her mother or her German heritage, and it talks about, is it Eugene McCarthy, who's also part German? But by this time, you know, you're so identified as Irish that you don't want to, you know, muddy the waters at all. And that also made me think, I mean, that's a very clear time period, too, where that was important. I mean, we don't do that anymore, do you think, in politics?
Well, I also think it was a time when you only talked about certain things and certain things weren't talked about. And it was really easy at that point to put things under the rug that you didn't want to talk about. I mean, now it's, you know, it's the day of the internet and Facebook and people pouring out their life. But during that time, people really just didn't get down and talk about their personal business. And, you know, maybe that she was old school enough to feel that way.
You put out only what you wanted to put out.
Yep.
Yeah, because her romantic life was certainly much more private. People speculated and...
Well, do you think that also, too? Maybe Heather can chime in, too, because from a journalist's view, maybe she thought that was a weapon that could be used against her and that she had always had the upper hand by being a little more elusive and keeping that completely off the table. So maybe she just wanted to not have any weaponry out there against her. She wrote some pretty scathing articles about people. And she made people pretty mad at some points now and again. So maybe that was her way of making sure nobody could go back on her.
Hmm. I don't really know what to say.
Yeah.
I can't speculate on the choices she made with keeping her private life private. But in terms of being a journalist, we try not to be the subject of the story. Something's gone horribly wrong if you're the subject of a news story as a reporter.
Right.
I mean, that's a very bad news day in my experience when I become the topic of someone else's news story.
And I would think, too, again, with that time period that, you know, she was Irish and she was Catholic. She certainly wouldn't want people speculating that she was, you know, engaging in sexual activity outside of marriage or any of those sort of things. Mm-hmm. Or like you said earlier, that there's any belief that she might leave the job. And so it was very on the hush-hush side in many ways.
Well, I think, and it goes back to a woman in the workplace, too. You can't really show weakness, you know? So maybe that again, is you're protecting any area that you might be weak at.
The hard copy of this book and the paperback have different titles. Mm. The hard copy is something about the first queen. And it almost seems like her persona is sort of like Queen Elizabeth, that above the fray and untarnished and not you know, sort of stripped the humanity away and you're this professional being, but not with the foibles of us regular folks in the same way that I think the queen plays that part.
Huh. And she was treated that way, mm-hmm. certainly in the newsroom mm-hmm. or in, on the campaign trail. And I mean, you know, you had to almost, I don't know, at the same time it was cringeworthy, you almost had to love that she would get people to carry her bags.
And I wish kinda... I knew how she did that.
That's a talent.
Well, I think you had to have a certain look. And I think, you know, even though they talk about that she's beautiful, I mean, you know, I don't know. But especially as she got older, you know, you kind of pull the little old lady trick or something, right? Or the weaker.
I think she had the tools and knew when to use them when she knew how to use them.
Well, and to be the only woman in a boys' club, I think you might have gotten more of the gentlemanly manners than what I would see now in mm-hmm. a situation where I'm mm-hmm. the only woman in a lot of, you know, male professionals. Mm-hmm.
So for our listeners, we are talking about Mary McRory, the trailblazing columnist who stood Washington on its head. And I'm here with Terry Snyder and Heather Rez. I think the other phenomenal thing about her is her longevity. And she's so loyal to the Washington Star. And she was there, what, over 30 years. And then she transitions to the Washington Post when the Star shuts down. And she's there for, what, 15, almost 20 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I love how she said, I'm never going to have a going away party at the Post because they don't serve liquor.
Yeah.
It was a tough transition at first to go from the Star, which was kind of seemed like a partying newsroom where there was, you know, liquor flowing and lots
of. Yeah, some of those stories are really funny, though. Some of the scenes were pretty great.
So, which brings me to, you know, I put on my kind of list of things I wanted to talk about is when I was reading this, especially in the, you know, the 50s and 60s time period, I guess, that I have a nostalgic kind of picture of the newsroom. And it comes from old black and white films. And I think I wrote a couple of them down, His Girl Friday and Woman of the Year. So I don't know. Do you have that? I mean, how does it compare to real life? What do you think?
Well, newsrooms are not a universal phenomenon. I mean, they have reporters working on stories and that's universal. But from there, it's the size of the organization you're working for and how many other people are there. And the Frontiersman newsroom is really probably not a really good indicator of
benchmark.
What the Star or Post newsroom might have been like. And even the part where she had a little cubicle she could work in, no one at the Frontiersman has an office. But when I was the editor there, I didn't even have an office. It was one big room and lots of noise and ongoing phone calls, you know, multiple phone calls at once and sort of lots of chaos mixed with deadlines.
But I think that's part of the romanticism of it, right, is all that's going on. I mean, people think, oh, you know, this is just such a hub of activity, an important activity.
I really can't speak to the romance of journalism. What I know is the like
Heather, play along.
Dirt in my teeth, mm-hmm. cuts and bruises and, you know, from doing the job and.
Well, maybe it's more of an outsider's point of view then, or is it just me?
Well, I think it's what we've seen. I think, you know, there's been a lot of TV shows and there's been movies about a newsroom. And so I think unless you've worked in them, you know, that's the scene that you kind of take away from it.
Yeah, you're not spending 8 hours there. You're just, you know, kind of.
Eight?
You would have been happy with eight, right?
Or 20.
In what universe?
In a day. You're not spending your day there. So you're just getting a little taste of it.
Yeah. Well, and that, you know, I think the other thing that was really interesting was the type of relationships that she got from other reporters that she talked about, Corky Roberts, and there were some other people that she talked about and how those changed as the book kind of moved on. And I wonder, I look at the press pools now, especially around the White House and how that's so changed and if any of those relationships are going to endure. I mean, her long relationship with Tim Russert. There's only going to be one Tim Russert. We all know that. And I think nostalgia is just kind of that nostalgia for the way life was mm-hmm. and the way our life was different. In the newsroom surely would be that way, too. Those relationships are much more superficial, it would seem, than they were before in her time.
Mm-hmm.
I think she was lucky to be when she was. in her time.
And at the same time, I mean, you pointed out she had an office and she also had an assistant because, you know, the other thing, you had to picture her in front of a typewriter. I mean, she didn't have a computer. They talked about how she kind of went dragging and kicking into the age of technology when she got her first computer. So she had an assistant who would do a lot of her research. And so, you know, you just have to picture the amount of work involved, you know, because I think she was a person of integrity. And so when she wrote, she was going to fact check and she was going to make sure that she had the correct information. And so that is a lot of, you know, looking in books and talking to people because you don't have Google.
Yeah. Life without the Google. Well, yeah. And I think she stayed out of the opinion part of the newspaper. And two, her long career, she was in the news section as opinionated as she was. And I think she got more so as she got older, but she fought her way and kept her way on the news. So what she was doing was newsworthy, which, I mean, that probably wouldn't happen these days either. Or maybe it's all opinion now. I don't know. there's some things.
Depends
that are,
on who you ask.
Yeah, there's some things that definitely have more opinion than fact. But I think that that was a big deal during her time.
I'm not aware of anyone else who has that spot on the front page. And even where she's writing really deeply researched and heavily reported things as opinion, still that real estate is not given up for opinion ever. I don't know of anyone besides this woman who ever got that real estate as an opinion writer.
I was surprised. Thanks for saying that, because I was going to ask, because I thought, really not on the op-ed page? So we should point out that McRory wrote columns. She wasn't necessarily a day-to-day journalist. Mm-hmm. In the
three
sense
columns
of,
a week for
yeah.
How many years? Yeah.
Oh, 50. And so, yeah, so that she was, and she fought getting placed on the op-ed, in the op-ed section.
Yeah, they said she wrote, I wrote down here that she wrote 8,000 columns and she only missed deadline once, which seems phenomenal.
Amazing. But I think that goes to, again, you know, when you talked about her as the queen, you know, that she had that level of respect that she could stay, you know, where she wanted her placement in the newspaper.
So I did have to Google her.
Mm-hmm.
And I was reading her obituaries and some of the feature pieces that were written at the time of her death. And one of the things that was, I guess, interesting from that reading was they're talking about the way she reported her columns, that she's actually going to the meetings with you and she's staying gavel to gavel, listening to it, doing reporting, getting other interviews. And then she's going back and she's writing that as an opinion piece. But she's doing all the legwork and getting all the source materials you would need to write a straight news story. But she's processing it through 40 years of experience covering the government and giving you, I think, in addition to that day's meeting, sort of like why all of this matters, sort of more context than you would get if you just sent newbie from college to do gavel-to-gavel straight news reporting about the same meeting.
Mm-hmm. Plus, she had these amazing relationships with White House staff, and so she could always fall back on that. I mean, she and the dinner parties that she would throw in at her house and be in, you know, invited into Air Force One to fly home at times. And she had this unfettered access that you just don't see anymore. Or very, very, very little of it, which just doesn't happen.
Very chummy,
very
almost
chummy.
Casual.
Yeah. And even what I was really impressed with her was even when she was pointing out their flaws and saying critical things, they might get, you know, tiffed for a while, but they always went back to her and they always, you know, maybe go back to that queen thing. They always went back for her approval and she went right back to being part of the group, which I think is pretty phenomenal right now.
There was something about her beyond just the really political columns, this slice of life stuff that she's doing about gardening and the just sort of random topics. I think it gave people the sense that they knew her as a person, that she was Aunt Mary or some sort of, they had more of a claim to her than just the Post columnist or Star columnist or whatever that. I mean, this is her neighbor died and she wrote a column about it.
Yeah.
that ran on the front page of newspapers around the country.
So when you read those, do you get, I mean, is there a different feeling to it? The topic is obviously very different from the political, but I mean, I'm sure the writing is just as beautiful, but was the feeling different or this is like, I'm talking to you.
I'm blown away that her editor would accept this. I don't mean that it's badly done or anything like that, but it's so far removed from your assignment is the political desk and politics. Your neighbor died and she was a really nice lady and you wrote this great slice of life thing about it. It's a fantastic piece of writing and sort of remembrance of her neighbor, but does it fit like with your political column? You have a very generous editor.
But she had an enormous amount of readers.
Definitely.
So, the latitude was probably definitely directly related to that the catnip she kept feeding was what they wanted. And, if they've shown that just because she wrote a garden column, they were going to stick with her. So that's what worked for them.
Well, and I think that's part of it, that you felt you knew her. Mm-hmm. And this is part of it, that she's sharing not about herself, but about people who are close to her and things that are important in a way where you feel a connection to her that, not just from George Will writing about politics or something, but it has another personal layer to it.
Yeah. And she wasn't wrong very often. I mean, it seems like she was pretty spot on about, I can't only remember maybe a couple of instances when she got it wrong, but she was pretty right on about what she wrote about, it seemed like.
History broke her way, kind of.
Yeah, yeah. It was an amazing trip of history that was really unexpected.
Oh, and I think that was almost a challenging part of reading this book, because we start with her in the 50s, and because she's covering politics and she's on the campaign trail, I don't know what, 11 times or something crazy, that we go through so much of our nation's history and it's collapsed into this. I mean, we barely get over Kennedy's death, and now we're talking about LBJ and the involvement in Vietnam. And so it's sort of like we have to trudge through our history and some pretty dark periods of our history.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a good reminder that we've had a lot of crazy. So as crazy as we feel right now, there has been those periods. And, we were probably at a stage of our life, even if we lived through them, that we just weren't as knowing as we are now. And it's just so much more in your face because of the internet. But there were some pretty crazy things going on with politics all the way through.
Like a lot of parallels to the Nixon Watergate era with contemporary.
Yeah. Right down to the enemies list.
Yes. Yes. And we'll talk some more about that. We're talking about Mary McRory, the trailblazing columnist who stood Washington on its head, by John Norris. And I have Heather Rez and Terry Snyder with me today. We are not taking calls because we are pre-recording, so hopefully you're enjoying the conversation. So we're talking about how much history is there, and I mean, it's almost like, what's the movie with Tom Hanks where he's present for every important thing? Forrest Gump. So in some ways, it's almost that kind of a feeling, like everything that is really critical in our nation's times, Mary is there for it. But, I think what we've been kind of doing is painting this picture of where the press corps was a very small group. It's a very intimate group, and not just physical closeness, but also knowing each other so well.
Mm-hmm. I think beyond her presence at these moments in history, there's also, she impacted some of these moments in history. It seems like Bobby Kennedy's decision to run was really her foot in his rear end.
Neck.
Yeah. Oh, okay. On his neck. That's better. Yeah, like you need to do this. You're just going to sit idly by, and you need to do this. And it seemed like that pressure, that public pressure, was the catalyst.
And so, given that, I mean, do you think Norris does a very good job then? Because I thought, oh my God, she must feel so guilty, and maybe she never confessed to that, or maybe she didn't feel guilty. But did you get a sense that Mary had some self-blame? Remorse over doing it? From the book?
I don't think so, because I think she maybe she did personally, because I have a feeling she didn't share totally her whole story, that's for sure. But, you know, she went on to keep a close companionship and was, even though she kind of admitted Ted Kennedy was not, had too many flaws to be, you know, come that person. I don't think she, I can't point to anything in the book that actually made me think that she felt responsible, or she did, certainly didn't say that I picked up, that I shouldn't have talked him into it. I think she thought that they were predestined to do it, particularly after Jack died.
I don't think she felt responsible for what happened, you know, later in that, that he was shot. I don't, I don't think she held any, she's responsible for that. But the, my point was more that she wasn't just present, but that because she was more than a reporter, she also felt really free to put her thumb on the scale and say, it should go this way. The Vietnam War is wrong. It should go this way. Here, I'll sit you down with the leaders of the resistance movement, and you can talk about it. And I mean, she didn't really make any bones about her politics.
Having a position. Having
right.
A position.
Right. Yeah. And she wasn't trying to walk a line like a reporter does, where you're not supposed to be biased and not supposed to have an opinion. She had an opinion and was paid to have an opinion. Mm-hmm. A heavily researched, heavily sourced, over 40 years or 50 years opinion. But it, I mean, I don't think she was ever shying away from, I shouldn't have an opinion.
So I see her as a forerunner for several of my favorite writers. So, you know, I really like Molly Ivins. Mm-hmm. I really like Gail Collins. And so, again, I have to ponder, why do I know these women and I don't know, you know, Mary McGrory? And it's not that, I mean, she died in what, 2004? So it's not like she's been gone that long.
I read Molly Ivins' book. I read Maureen Dowd's book. Mm-hmm. She doesn't have a book.
Mm-hmm.
This
exactly.
is the only book. So her immortality is this and these columns.
Mm-hmm.
Because there isn't, we never got to interview her about her life. We don't have those first person anecdotes about.
Well, and you know, how much of the Washington Post did you read? And you know, the Star, if you were on the East Coast, I don't know, I didn't grow up on the East Coast. Maybe if you were on the East Coast, that would be a more familiar name to you. But, you know, we here, they those weren't typically in our newspapers. Now we use them for filler a lot. And so we see a lot more of those national news articles and opinion pieces, and we share them like mad on the internet. But she lived in a day where, you know, you kind of read the newspaper where you grew up. And if you were raised on the West Coast, that's probably who you read.
Well, and even the fact that she was syndicated might not have changed that, because if your community has a small paper, you don't have a budget for syndicated anything.
Mm-hmm.
So those 150 or whatever nameplates she was on, those are all metro areas that have budgets for syndicated columnists and AP and things like that, not the Frontiersman.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or any of the newspapers up here, probably.
Maybe the Dispatch. I mean, they have some national columnists,
but I don't think
right at the time.
Case. Yeah.
So we are at the bottom of the hour, and we are talking about the Mary McGrory book, and you are listening to Radio Free Palmer 89.7. This is Radio Book Club on Big Cabbage Radio. I'm Judy Getty, and my guests are Terry Snyder and Heather Rez. So we're going to travel back a little bit more with the history here and Mary and her journalism career. When I appreciate what you said, though, before about Ivins and Collins and even Dowd, because I think I was introduced to them through books.
Their own books.
Yeah, through their own books. So I think that makes sense. I wanted to point out, because, you know, you feel a little bit maybe again nostalgic, because when you're reading about some of the dark side, you think, oh my gosh, if we could only go back to that. That was such a, you know, pleasant dark side in some ways. It was almost like a, you know, semi-twilight instead of dark side. But I made a note here about they made a big deal about Muskie referring to Canadians as Canucks.
Oh, yeah.
And how insulting, and, you know, what a terrible thing he had done. And you know, this is 1972. And so, you know, I mean, it doesn't even come close to the kind of mudslinging we do.
I didn't know that was a bad word. Like, how many times have I said that and didn't know that that's an offensive description of our neighbors?
Maybe.
Anyway, I apologize.
You didn't mean to be insulting.
I had no idea.
Maybe it isn't anymore, but in 1972, apparently it was.
Yeah. And she said some other, I mean, she just had a very witty tongue, which I, of course, appreciated about her. But she once said about Nixon that if he were a horse, I would not buy him, which I don't think you have to say very much more than that. I mean, that was just a great statement.
She never liked Nixon.
She never liked Nixon.
And from the late 50s, she found fault with him. And she really thought he was going to be out of the picture when he lost.
He spent so much time, John Norris, talking about what a great writer she was. I sort of felt compelled to go and find her columns and read them just to hear her voice and enjoy that language. And I really wish there was a book of her. Is there a book of her columns?
I don't know.
I thought I saw one on Amazon, like a collection of them, but it, you know, after her death, it had been published. But that, you know, the promise of great prose, he kept saying, it's there, and like, well, show me, like, get out of the way. Well,
you can find most of them online. I mean,
Heather, you handed me this column, and just some of the names of them I'm going to go look up. Not a Week for Reality, Panic City, USA. I mean, just some really, you know, What About This Crisis? The Karl Rove Show, just some of those makes me want to go and read her columns. So
I have the one on Karl Rove leave with you.
Oh,
I do.
Well,
I printed that one.
What
did
you think about it?
I don't think I read the whole thing.
But you do get a sense of, I mean, her wonderful writing style.
Well, and much of the criticism of that talking head seems very like the conversation we're having now about sources like InfoWars and Breitbart, that instead of getting information from places that do research and fact check, it's from talking heads and opinion things without that underpinning and fact and reality and research to support what you say into the mic.
So is that what you were thinking about these as you read them, that that was the case, or hers was, do you think hers was based on that? Or
no, I think hers is the other extreme, that she's going gavel to gavel to all these meetings and deeply researching and sourcing things.
Right.
And yes, their opinion, but it's not the same thing as vomiting opinion into a mic without any research, without any facts, without any reporting. And that's what Karl Rove and Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and that sort of spacious argument without a basis in reality is.
Towards the end, she had some pretty harsh words for Rush Limbaugh. So she
did I pull the wrong one?
Yeah, she went through some of that. And she put him out, pulled him out specifically out of that group of people that were doing that and doing damage.
So, yeah, and you know, I think after 2004, it just obviously gets worse. But she was getting a little taste of it, that there was more online punditry and people who were doing like what you were saying. They're reporting on other people's stories rather than going deeper.
Sourcing them themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She also recognized the big difference. And I thought this was kind of just, I hadn't thought about it, just the changes in the newsroom when television came about. You know, and then there was that, we know there was a big difference in newsroom when the internet came about, but you just don't often think about the changes to newspapers when television came, and that, you know, that was really the beginning of the sky is falling. Nobody's going to read newspapers anymore, even though they've, you know, plugged through to this. But I had forgotten that, that they all went through that transition of television. And I thought that was pointed out pretty nicely.
Well, the whole struggle with what time the star should be put out. And so when they wanted it not to be an afternoon edition, how many editions were they doing a day? Five or something? Just insane. And so, but the late or the afternoon one, the early evening one was especially hard to get
delivered.
Yeah, because of the traffic.
Who would have thought?
Yeah.
This is her, the part about the Drudge Report. Mary was outraged by the president's behavior, dubbing him a dog patch Don Giovanni and adding, if Clinton had any shame, he would have long since expired of it. But she was also horrified by the great roar of innuendo stoked by a whole new source, internet blogs like the right-wing Drudge Report. Mary had never been a fan of opinion delivered without actual reporting, and suddenly the internet offered a Pandora's box of instant punditry that was uncouth, unkind, and often uninformed.
Well said. I made a note here that, and we've touched on this a little bit, but so many presidents, you know, she was covering so many presidents, and oftentimes, and it almost didn't matter, Republican or Democrat, they both referred to the Mary problem.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like you said, she had the thumb on the scale. And so she could sway people to her way of thinking, or at least in a way that might have created some discomfort or challenges for a president. And so, you know, oftentimes she was discussed as a problem.
Yeah. And I think that's probably due to the fact that she was, she knew them better than they knew themselves in a lot of ways. And that she was able to, she just had a great way of being able to put those little pieces out to bring that to people's attention, that they had those flaws or that they had done the wrong thing without, you know, breaking a bridge where she couldn't go back and have a relationship with them. And that's a very hard thing to do. I think it's exceedingly hard now, but I think even in that time, it was hard to have those relationships with people so that they would confide in you and trust you enough so that you had the access to them. And at the other hand, you would say what was needed to be said about them. That's a very hard thing to do.
I didn't get the sense that she ever destroyed them, or that they wanted to destroy her in kind. But that, you know, so by calling her the Mary problem, it wasn't like, you know, snuff her out or get her fired or anything like that.
Well, she was on the Nixon's list.
Well, she was.
On the Nixon's list. She made that one.
Yeah, she was very proud of that.
Yes, she's very proud of that.
The enemies list. Yeah. So maybe, okay, but he was an exception in so many ways.
Yes, that's true.
But I think other than that, I mean, they wanted to get her to get back on board with her, because I think it was like, it was called the Mary problem, but we need to get back into Mary's good graces. Yeah. How are we going to do that?
Yeah. She had the power of the pen.
Certainly.
We talked a little bit about how she sort of has her thumb on the scale and influences history. This is where she sat next to the Irish army, the head of the Irish Republican Army. And her question to him was it really necessary to shoot all those fathers in front of their children? Anyway, they did eventually reach peace. And I can't help but wonder if he ever got that question out of his ears when they're negotiating. You know, that's a pretty straight to the heart of it.
Yes, absolutely.
Whatever you've been asked, you probably didn't think of it in those terms before she insisted.
What year was that? During the
84.
So she's, by that time, she was born in what, 1919 or something like that. So she's about 65. Because I just think there's something about it. If you picture an elderly person and you picture maybe an elderly woman, she probably got
away with that.
Yeah, she could get away with some of that.
Well, that's something to look forward to.
We're not even close to that, as I was just saying, something to look forward to. Not there yet.
Yeah.
So besides Nixon, I kind of made a list of some of the other people she was not too fond of. You know, just some of the small stories, I guess, that happened in different presidencies. So there was the story about Reagan, and I wasn't really clear. There was this money, and so this lawyer says, just give it to charities. And so dispersed.
He wasn't donated. He didn't donate much of his own personal wealth. And that came to her attention, that such a small percentage of what he actually was worth, and he was worth millions, that he actually gave to charity.
But there was another part where it was some government money that went to charities or something, and then he wanted it back. And so she did this big story about, you know, all these charities, how are they going to get this money to...
That was right at the start of his presidency, right? He made this decision, and then she...
called him out on it?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And... the press secretary called and said, never mind, it's going back.
Because here's Mary's resulting columns blazed about, quote, grim feds bursting into a hovel demanding from the resident widow the return of taxpayers' money for her belated winter fuel.
Oh, yeah.
You're not going to win any friends painting that picture.
Yeah, exactly.
So any others that stood out for you that...
She wasn't a fan of Newt Gingrich, I know that. She had some pretty fierce words for him. But he didn't seem to, he was in his own other world, I think. But she was there and he was gone. So she didn't have anything nice to say about him by and large.
She lasted longer than him. I think One of the big ones was her response to 9/11. Mm-hmm. So, this is so recent, we can all kind of remember this, but that was such an eggshell time. And so for a columnist to come out and say the president didn't handle that well, and, you know, talking about—
That was risky.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, she got a lot of hate mail at that time.
Well, she got another round of hate mail when she agreed with Colin Powell in his speech saying we should go to war and all this justification. She wrote this one called I'm Persuaded. And I think, is this the one that she wished she could take back? We were all persuaded. He was the one guy that maybe could have persuaded a nation that this war was right. And it wasn't just her that swallowed the hook. Mm-hmm. It was, you know.
Most of the country.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She was in good company and being deceived by that speech.
But you can't say 100%, because I think the mail that she got afterwards, they called her like a turncoat and they said, you know, I can't believe you've gone to the other side. They saw her as somebody now
the
who,
dark side.
Yeah, who had flipped. And I think her apology column after that one was like, okay, I don't know if she was trying to take some of it back or clarify or whatever, but to say, I'm not agreeing that we should go to war, but he convinced me of some of the kind of the elements of what they were saying.
Or that at some point there may be no other, it may be necessary, there may not be another option or something.
When did the news of like there was no weapons of mass destruction come out? I wonder if Mary ever felt vindicated, because even Colin Powell was, you know, giving bad information.
She passed away in 2004.
I don't think we had confirmation there weren't weapons of mass destruction until January 20 this year when Donald Trump took over. And then it became popular to argue that the FBI and the CIA were wrong, that they hadn't really given good information about this. And then the conversation. I mean, this is another conspiracy theory where there's a whole group of us that have been in denial about whether there were weapons of mass destruction for the better part of 20 years.
Well, let it be known then that we've told Mary that it's been confirmed. And she was She's vindicated yeah. now. Yes, we'll give her that credit.
Well, I think it's even more than that. It's like somebody who was really an insider that could be persuaded. How you know, it was easy for some, not easy. I mean, she didn't go easy for it. But, I mean, it happens, and that it's a good it's a lesson learned, probably, when someone like that believes it.
We're talking about Mary McGrory, a trailblazing columnist who stood Washington on its head. You're listening to Radio Free Palmer, Radio Book Talk. So the one that I printed out, because it was actually in one of the reviews, so I thought they were going to say something about it in the book, but she wrote, and this is from 1990, What Cards Those Trumps Are, because she's writing about Ivana's and Donald's divorce. And so what her point in this is that, you know, compared to them, Washington looked really tame. So, I mean, you know, again, I think just for Mary to know that eventually the story that she wrote on this guy ends up, you know, sitting in the White House, she would love to come back and have that column again.
Yeah, that's one to read.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find an archive of her star columns as well?
You know, I didn't look. Would the star archived?
I don't know. I didn't get that far. I found this landing page on the Post that has a year or so of columns. But I don't know where the Star Archive ended up, but you found that, so I thought maybe it was part of that era.
That's from the Post.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a whole list of them, of her Post columns, and I think they're probably all worth reading at some point in time. Because this is, you know, her words probably are powerful even now with some of the titles that I see.
When we look at, because I think that this is still, you know, we talked about her column on Colin Powell, and she's convinced. Do you think that there are writers still today that you know, if you read them, you think, well, if that writer says it, if that columnist says it, that's somebody that I believe in. In other words, somebody who would have the same kind of power that Mary had. Okay, we're getting radio, so everybody's looking kind of like, I don't know.
It's funny because the ones I think of are pretty partisan. It doesn't mean they aren't good columnists. Mm-hmm. And they're partisan from, you know, David Brooks can be good to read. Right now he's good to read because I think you kind of gravitate to people that you have the same opinion of.
I enjoy Maureen Dowd from
time
to time.
Dowd, yeah.
And maybe more in the past than contemporary, but.
I've always liked Leonard Pitt.
Charlie Rose is what someone's saying here. I like Charlie Rose. I think that he is, I really like John Dickinson, who's now with Channel 11. And I think he, and of course his mother was a news, you know, and he's been raised around it because Nancy Dickerson was also a news reporter for a long time. And I think he's very, he's much like cut from the same cloth. He can be opinionated, but he is a factual journalist at heart. And so he is probably, he can get kind of wonky sometimes, but I really appreciate his work.
Is there anyone who's mixed sort of the political and Rose's together like she did? The slice of life with the...
Gail Collins?
Well, and is Gail still writing? And she writes for The Post,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I like her books. I don't subscribe to The Post, so I have to look up her articles if I read them.
Maureen Dowd is kind of that way. I can't think of anybody that I don't. It's really even hard to find anybody that uses humor in a way that it seems to be sort of a humorless time right now.
I think that was part of her. What made her blade so sharp was the mix of the humor. She's describing President Reagan as President Reagan has instituted policies that are hard on people. They're even mean. He shamelessly chooses guns over butter. While ever striving to permit the rich to keep more of their money, he's tried to make sure that the poor don't get too much. That just sounds like Tuesday.
Yeah.
Like not Reagan
pieces.
Era. But,
so part of my question was, you know, how would you think Mary would respond to, you know, the current political climate?
I think she would say government can pay both pay the bills and still help people in wheelchairs.
Yeah.
And that's a quote.
Which was a quote. Yeah. Page 209.
She had several quotes about it seems like that about Reagan. And I thought, you know, there's been a lot of praying to the mantle of Reagan, as I've sort of pointed out on the other show about that people all want to be even the Democrats on one side rush to the side to put him up on a mantle. And you read those things about what he said and done, mm-hmm. and
also
you wonder.
His dementia diagnosis.
She made mention of that too.
But when we're idolizing him,
mm-hmm.
the man had dementia. At what point did his decision start being impacted by your brain is a melting ice cube? You're not really here anymore.
Yeah,
I think same sort of concern is with the present administration as well. Like some of these behaviors just seem like dementia and all Alzheimer's, and maybe your kids should get you checked.
Yeah, definitely.
When you said that about humor, do you think that because, you know, we have so many different ways to you know, reflect the current political scene that, you know, so I think about John Oliver and I think about, Trevor Noah. And
that's
so now
true.
We've got, you know, those kinds of people weighing in and providing news, but certainly with humor. Samantha Bee.
I think that's a good point.
That's a really good point. Maybe they've taken the mantle of that. Not so much columnists. And, you know, that's where we get a lot of our entertainment.
But also in the part where that isn't just straight comedy. It's heavily researched, heavily reported with a punchline.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's almost that, you know, can we laugh or should we, you know, cry? So,
yeah.
So what about Garrison Keillor? Does he do political reflection?
He's been doing more recently, for sure. But he's retiring, too, although I don't know that he'll ever put the pen down. But even here, we had Dugan for a long time, Mike Dugan, who I thought was a great read when he was writing. And I miss his pithy columns, too.
Mm-hmm. I think Julia O'Malley is a little in this vein, where heavily researched reporting, kind of slice of life, make you care about the people, not just give you the news.
I think another new avenue, too, is just some of what I've seen with Dan Rather and his Facebook posts.
Yeah.
That are, too. I mean.
Filling the freedom.
Yeah. And but, you know, that would be this type of column if he still, you know, was in the.
How about Bill Moyers? I mean, he's not exactly, there's not the humor in it so much, but it is definitely serious journalism what he does, and very enjoyable to read and listen to. Same sort of era. She doesn't make comment about him, does she?
I don't think so. So, you know, we've tossed out all these names. So do you think that having, you know, this kind of new list of players, does that fill the void of someone like Mary? Or do we just, you know, we're getting it in many different ways now? And is this part of, you know, the kind of the dying, unfortunately, of our newspapers?
Go ahead.
That level of experience that she has from covering one beat for 30 or 40 years is irreplaceable. And we definitely don't have that now, whether it's at the local level where somebody's been to the assembly meeting every time for the last how many years?
I don't know. Too many.
10?
Too many. Yeah.
I'll ask Houston. I'm sure.
Yeah. 10, at least. Yeah, that is true. I think that level probably, and I don't know, I like to think of everything as sort of a transition. It's a different evolution. And I know this was really a good book, and I will say up front, I had a hard time just finding time to read, sit down and read a book. I'm guilty of that. I do an enormous amount of reading, but it's a lot of articles, and it's a lot of assembly packets and a lot of other things. So I think we've just taken, our level of reading is so much different than it used to be. But I think there will be a place for newspapers. You know, it may be that there's, you know, we're in that transition right now where people are getting their content so differently. You know, people are still subscribing to magazines, although more and more are doing it online just for the convenience of having them. I have a Kindle because it's the convenience of traveling with a Kindle, but I still prefer to have a nice book in my hand to be able to read a book.
You have both?
I have both. yeah, well, that's a long story. But I think that, you know, I still have tons and tons of hardbound books that I want to get through in a stack by my bedside that mm-hmm. are still there. So I have a feeling, even just looking at my grandkids and how they're consuming, they're still reading hardbound books. And I have a lot of friends whose kids still read hardbound books. And when they go to bed at night, they're not allowed electronic devices, but they can take their book and read it for a while. So I like to think that print media is going to survive, that it's just there's a comfort. As much as I like my Kindle and the ease of using that and being able to travel with it, I still get much more comfort out of holding a book. And I think that's the same thing with the newspaper. When I traveled a lot, I think Mike and I have talked about this, the first thing we do is get a local newspaper. We don't get it online. A lot of them have paywalls that you're not going to subscribe to read once. But if you really want to find out what's going on in a community, you pick up their newspaper. You look at their real estate ads. You look at, you know, sometimes just their local news and their what's going on in their community. That's how you get a flavor for what's in the community. So I don't think newspapers are going to go away anytime soon. I think they're just going to evolve. I don't know. What do you think? You're an ex-newspaper person. So are you that optimistic, Heather?
Probably not. I don't know what will happen. It's been hard to watch what's happened to the media locally and nationally. And I hope there is a renaissance and it swings back the other way.
Well, if you look at the Washington Post, I mean, I'm a subscriber to the Washington Post now and the New York Times, and it's because of the times we're in.
Online?
I do it because, I wouldn't get the newspaper at my door, number one. But secondly, I want to support good journalism. And mm-hmm. I know that that's one reason that the Post has been doing great work right now is they've been putting a lot of money into their reporters that are doing good journalism. And that's the way we keep our society accountable, is to have good, hard journalism. And I think that I have to be part of that support. So there's, you know, maybe six of them that I support. And I think that's kind of our obligation to society to to do that.
And I would say that if there's going to be any transition, I would think that it's going to just go to, we're going to just consume more of the written word in an electronic format.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's because of convenience, and I think it's because of resources.
Yeah. Yeah. I do think there might be a bit of a swing, and I hope this is true. And I hope this happens, that the newspapers that do end up surviving it, or like the Washington Post, are less dependent on advertising and more dependent on people like me that will pay for content. You know, I pay for the Juno Empire. I pay for the ADN. I pay for the Frontiersman. And I want to make sure that we have local journalism. And I think I don't get them at my door. But I think we have to support those efforts.
I've been flipping through here trying to find this spot where he talks about TV and the impact. Mm. Phil Bennett chipped in. We begin where they leave off. They show you the bombs falling. We tell you what happened after the bombs fell, why they loosed, and what the future may hold.
Yeah.
That's the difference between newspapers and TV.
So recognizing they both have a different mission, really.
Right.
We're going to get different things from them.
And that in-depth reporting and coverage is what you get from newspapers, what we rely on from newspapers.
Another good reason for people to support them.
Yes. Would you recommend the book?
Absolutely. I'm really happy that you got me to do this, because I probably wouldn't have read it. Would have gone by my nightstand as a good recommendation from a friend who I admire, who reads a lot. But I wouldn't have had to read it had I not had to been here today.
Glad I did some arm twisting.
You did, and I really appreciate it.
It was a good read.
Really good read.
I didn't realize that she is the reporter who asked Hillary Clinton the question about baking cookies.
Oh, yeah.
It was phenomenal.
She asked it? I remember that story being in there.
She did ask it.
Mary had asked Hillary Clinton the now famous question about the balance between being a professional woman and a mother. Clinton's response to Mary was, "I suppose I could have stayed home and baked cookies and had teas, but what I decided to do was fulfill my profession, which I entered before my husband was in public life."
So she didn't ask the question, but it certainly prompted that whole conversation where Hillary was almost forced to say she would bake cookies just to show she had that, like, feminine side.
Right. I don't know what Mary said to prompt that, but she was the reporter having the conversation with Clinton that produced that very famous comment.
So many momentous occasions. So I want to thank Heather and Terry for joining me today as we talked about Mary McGrory, the trailblazing columnist who stood Washington on its head by John Norris. Please join me next month when we will be reading and discussing Elizabeth Warren's 2014 memoir, A Fighting Chance. I guess I'm just in a political kind of mood. But it was a book that one of my guests, Deborah Guy-Dosh, picked. And so she will be joining me and Becky Stopa. So
great.
I want to remind listeners that 89.7 is a community radio station that relies on support from listeners like you. So please take the time to visit our website, radiofreepalmer.org, and become a contributing member. Also, please consider us for the Pick, Click, Give program when you file for your PFD. This is Judy Getty with Radio Book Club. Happy reading.